To RPH provides this edition of the Newcastle Herald for Friday, the 19th of April, for listening on demand. We remind you that the program is copyright and, in accordance with our agreement with the publisher, is available for a period of 24 hours only from the time of original broadcast completion. You're reminded, as this is a recording, all included time calls should be disregarded.
Graph.
Your radio reading service, 2RPH, brings you news, comment and letters from the pages of today's Newcastle Herald.
And good morning on this Friday, April 19. So we keep saying we're only here one day a week, but that week seems to be going faster and faster, and April is going faster, so we're almost through a quarter of the year. We've got next week, of course, Anzac Day falling next Thursday, and then we're at the end of April, we're into May, and almost halfway through. But we won't talk about that because you tend to wish your life away doing that. But as I say, it is April the 19th. School holidays at the moment too, so that's a good thing. I think traffic's a bit lower, and anybody else who's lucky enough to be on holidays, in school holidays, hope you're having an enjoyable time. Looks like showers coming over the weekend, or at least today and tomorrow for the Newcastle area, but then not too bad for the week ahead. Peter, I'm with you this morning. Annie Carr is here also. Good morning, Annie.
Good morning, Peter. Hello, listeners.
And we hope you stay with us between now and 11:30 for today's edition of the Newcastle Herald. Commencing with the weather, there's one in memoriam today, so we'll do that. Then we'll do the front page of today's Newcastle Herald, followed by the local news. That'll take us through to about 11 o'clock, where we'll do sport, then the editorials, the letters and some birthdays. It's currently 19 degrees in Newcastle. We're looking at a day becoming cloudy, very high chance of showers along the coastal fringe, medium chance elsewhere, the chance of a storm along the coastal fringe and light winds, a top temperature of 23 degrees for Newcastle today. Tomorrow we have a cloudy day with a high chance of showers, the chance of a storm, light winds becoming south to southeasterly, 15 to 25 kilometres per hour in the morning, and 21 degrees for Newcastle tomorrow. Sunday is a shower or two, 24. Partly cloudy on Monday, 24. Tuesday, partly cloudy, 25. Partly cloudy Wednesday, but warmer, 26. And for Thursday, Anzac Day, we have a shower or two and 23 degrees. Maitland today, shower or two developing, 23. Tomorrow, it's showers and 20. Shower or two on Sunday, 23. Partly cloudy on Monday, 24. Partly cloudy Tuesday, 25. Mostly sunny on Wednesday, 27. And for Anzac Day, there may be a shower or two, but mostly sunny and 23 degrees. Going up the coast, Nelson Bay, 21 degrees. Raymond Terrace, 22. On the Barrington Tops, they have 12 degrees today. Over to Scone, it's 21. Muswellbrook, 21. Singleton, 23. Maitland, I told you, 23. Cessnock, 23, and Toronto has 22 degrees. The sun rose this morning at 21 minutes past 6, and the days, as it keeps saying, getting shorter. The sun will set tonight at 28 minutes past 5. Going around the country, we have showers in Cairns and 30, mostly sunny in Brisbane, 28. Showers in Sydney, forecast 22 degrees. Shower or two in Canberra, 18. Showers in Melbourne, 18. Mostly sunny in Hobart, 18. There's a shower or two in Adelaide, 20 degrees. Fine in Perth and a very warm 31. Windy up in Broome, 37. Fine in Darwin, 35. And fine in Alice Springs and 25 degrees. We take a trip around the world now with Annie.
Thank you, and this is the high temperatures around the world on my list. Amsterdam, rain and 9 degrees. Athens, showers, 23. Auckland will have showers and 21 degrees. Bangkok is the warmest with a haze and 38. Barcelona, sunny and 19. Beijing, cloudy and 19. Christchurch, showers and 21. Frankfurt will have rain and 10 degrees. And the coolest temperature is at Helsinki, cloudy with only 4 degrees. Hong Kong, showers and 31. Johannesburg, fine and 25. Kuala Lumpur will have storms and 34 degrees. London, cloudy and 14. Los Angeles, fog and 23. Moscow, rain and 11 degrees. Noumea, showers and 28. Paris will be cloudy with 12 degrees. Port Vila, showers and 31. Rio de Janeiro, cloudy and 29 degrees. Rome will have rain and 19. Seoul, fine and 25. Singapore, storms and 33 degrees. Suva, storms and 32 degrees. Tel Aviv will be fine, 23. Tokyo, fine and 26. Vancouver, sunny, 16 degrees. Washington, 21 degrees. And finally, Wellington, fine and 17 degrees.
I'm Jonathan Holmes, and this is Radio 2RPH, providing readings of the Newcastle Herald every weekday from 10 a.m. and Saturdays from 2 p.m.
With the cooperation of the Newcastle Herald, 2RPH presents a summary of death notices from today's edition.
And they can be found on page 64. There's only one in memoriam today. Gary Foster, born on the 22nd of the 2nd, 1970, died on the 19th of April, 2019. In loving memory of our son, brother and uncle, always in our thoughts and forever in our hearts, you will never be forgotten. Sadly missed by mum, dad and family and the Waratah Mayfield Cricket Club. That's Gary Foster, born at 22nd of the 2nd, 1970, passed away on the 19th of the 4th, 2019.
You're listening to news from Newcastle and the Hunter region from the pages of The Herald.
And the front page of today's Newcastle Herald, change in the wind. Port of Newcastle has released a vision of how a future offshore wind manufacturing facility could transform the port over the next decade. It's going to be a huge operation, the port's Raymond Hole said. It will probably be on a similar scale to building ships in Adelaide. As seen in the artist's impression, manufacturing would be at several locations, including the North Arm and Walsh Point. Matthew Kelly has the full story. That'll be on page 4. The other front page story to be read by Annie.
Flu wave warning, and this by Damon Cronshaw. The Hunter has been warned to prepare for a sizeable influenza wave this winter, while two other viruses that target children have made an ominous return. Bad cases of RSV, that's respiratory syncytial virus, in the Hunter New England Health District quadrupled to 383 in February and 614 in March when compared with the same months last year. The New South Wales Respiratory Surveillance Report, released on Thursday, said RSV activity remains at high levels. This has included emergency department presentations and hospital admissions for children aged 0 to 4 years old with bronchitis, which is mainly caused by RSV. David Durham, a Hunter Health public health physician, said RSV and whooping cough had bounced back with increases. They're behaving very much like they did prior to the pandemic. The possibility of influenza responding the same way is very real. Influenza cases, now at low levels, are expected to soar in winter. We will probably prepare ourselves for a sizable influenza wave, Dr. Durham said. The flu vaccine is now available broadly through general practices, aged care facilities and pharmacies. Flu cases in the district hit monthly highs last year of 2,003 in July and 1,770 in June, 1,049 in August and 793 in May. The district's highest monthly flu cases since 2012 were 9,101 in June of 2022, far higher than the 5,878 in August of 2017. The figures refer to people unwell enough to seek medical attention and take a PCR test. The Australian Technical Advisory Group on Immunisation, that's the ATAGI, recommends the influenza vaccine for all people aged 6 months and over, saying an annual vaccination was the most important way to prevent influenza and its complications. Those complications can include ear and sinus infections, pneumonia and sepsis. While protection is generally expected to last throughout the year, the high level occurs in the first 3 to 4 months after vaccination, it stated. An RSV vaccine for pregnant women, approved by the TGA last month, is expected to be available next year. And we go from the front page to page two now. This will enable mums to transmit antibodies to their babies, protecting them in the first few months of life. This vaccination method has occurred in New South Wales for whooping cough since 2015. Meanwhile, data released on Thursday showed 146 PCR-confirmed COVID cases in Hunter, New England, in the week to April the 13th. The district recorded 616 COVID cases in March, compared to 4,074 in the same month last year. COVID is at low levels at the moment, which is fantastic, Dr. Durham said. The district had 39 people with COVID in hospital, with one in ICU and 14 aged care outbreaks, he said. The patterns with COVID are that we always get a winter wave and we're also getting a summer wave. The latest data showed 10.6% of Hunter residents aged 18 and over had a COVID vaccination in the last 6 months. This rose from 9.9% in March. Dr. Durham urged people to consider a booster if they had not had a COVID infection or jab in the last 6 months. When they roll up their sleeves for their influenza booster, it's a good idea to get a COVID booster as well, he said. You can get the two at the same time, one in each arm. New South Wales research from RMI University and Monash University found COVID vaccines prevented the death of 17,760 people aged 50 and over in New South Wales from August 2021 to July 2022. The death rate in unvaccinated people aged 50 and over was 7.7 times higher than those double vaccinated and 11.2 times higher than those who received a booster. So that was the front page, and continued on page two, flu wave warning, and that was by Damon Cronshaw.
I'm Barbara Sullivan.
And I'm Marnie Roper.
And I'm Elaine Jontek.
Together, we produce ABLE, interviewing experts on new assistive technologies and initiatives designed for people living with disabilities.
From navigational aids for the blind to festival and theatre accessible, we cover it all.
So join us to hear about these exciting developments at 3pm this day, repeated the following Monday at 9:30pm. Or listen to the AbleQuest podcast through RPH website.
This is Swan, and you're tuned to 2RPH, providing readings of the Newcastle Herald every weekday from 10 and Saturdays from 2pm.
Quarter past 10 on 2RPH, your radio reading service, page 2. In today's Newcastle Herald, appeal to wage all-out war on fire ant menace. This is by Tracy. Australia must continue to its decades-long war on fire ants, but big changes are needed to defeat the super pest, an inquiry has found. More than 23 years have passed since red imported fire ants were found in Brisbane, and authorities have been trying to stamp them out since. Federal senators have months reviewing eradication efforts in southeast Queensland and handed down their report on Thursday. Found Australia can't afford to give up the fight, given estimates of a $2 billion annual hit to the national economy if they break out of the southeast and become entrenched. Witnesses told the inquiry agricultural output could plummet by 40%. The health system could be strained by an extra 100,000 medical appointments per year, and native species could vanish if the high aggressive swarming get away. Other nations spend billions of dollars a year to limit agricultural losses, so to keep parks, sports fields and residential backyards fire ant free. They've called for a fresh review to determine if $1.28 billion committed by federal, state and territory governments to 2027 is enough, and if it isn't, to come up with a new figure. They say governments must guarantee an uninterrupted flow of cash to end the stop-start funding woes that have eradication. They want the government to consider whether a new model is needed to deliver the program, including an independent statutory agency and a nationally led commission. A national awareness campaign and more border spot checks on materials that are being moved out of southeast Queensland. The Invasive Species Council was among those to address the inquiry and has welcomed the recommendations, saying the outcome of the fire ants war will depend on what governments do next. Fire ants campaigner Rhys Pianta says there's no time to lose with fire ants recently detected in New South Wales. I'm impressed by the committee's report. It's a roadmap to follow, and the ball is now in the Australian government's court, he said. He says Australians must understand fire ants pose a threat to their way of life, and everyone has something to lose. History will judge the government that walks away from fire ants very harshly, particularly while there's still a chance to do something about it. National Senator Matt Canavan chairs the group that ran the inquiry and says it's time to end funding shortfalls, excessive bureaucracy and transparency issues that have plagued eradication efforts. It's imperative that all Australian governments act quickly before they spread past the point where eradication is still possible, he wrote in the inquiry's report. Green Senator Peter Whish-Wilson sat on the inquiry and believes its recommendations are too weak. The government doesn't need any further leeway to explore its options. It needs to act. There was appeal to wage all-out war on fire ant menace. That was by Tracy Ferrier on page 2.
And we're turning to page 3 now. The main article, shootings, firebombs and drugs. Arrest over cocaine found at ocean baths. New South Wales beaches allegedly unravels web. And this article is by Anna Falkenmeier. The man allegedly behind a botched plot to import almost a ton of cocaine into Australia has been dramatically arrested after bricks of the drug washed up on beaches and at the Newcastle baths. The Australian Federal Police, AFP, charged a 36-year-old man who went by the handles Wanted and the name of notorious US gangster John Dillinger on encrypted social media platforms after they homed in on him in Brisbane on Wednesday as part of a major multi-agency operation. Police allege the man was the head of a domestic crime network who directed the collection and distribution of multiple massive drug imports into Australia by sea. Police further claim the Aspley man was violent and threatening in his bid to collect debts and intimidate rivals by engaging criminal mates to firebomb, shoot at, extort and assault his customers. The man's arrest followed a complex year-long investigation, codenamed Operation Groot, by the Queensland Joint Organised Crime Task Force, made up of officers from the AFP, Queensland Police, Australian Border Force, the Department of Home Affairs and the Australian Criminal Intelligence Commission. A mystery which captivated the state was sparked when a barnacle-covered bricks of cocaine started washing up on New South Wales beaches before Christmas last year. The AFP man was a key player in the botched plot to import almost 900 kilograms of cocaine off the Queensland coast in November 2023. "We will allege the collection at sea was actually unsuccessful," AFP Detective Superintendent Adrian Telfer said. When police learnt this collection was unsuccessful, a coordinated search was undertaken by all of our partner agencies. However, the drugs could not be located. But it was only a week. It was only weeks later when the beachgoers out for a stroll or swim began to stumble across suspicious packages, allegedly from international ships. "We believe these drugs were offloaded into the ocean," Detective Superintendent Telfer said. "There were adverse weather conditions. We believe they were a significant factor into why they couldn't recover the drugs." The first barnacle-covered cocaine brick was discovered on the central coast, but packs soon began washing up or being pulled from the ocean along the east coast. A sack stuffed with 39 one-kilogram packs was found at Newcastle Ocean Baths on December the 26th. About 256 kilograms of the 900 kilogram shipment had been seized by New South Wales police so far. There was understandably community concern when cocaine washed up on the beaches, beaches where our children play, swim and eat, Detective Superintendent Telfer said. "The AFP and our partners dedicated a significant amount of resources to ensure we have kept the public safe and brought those allegedly responsible before the courts. People are still investigating where the drugs came from, but they said they saw South American as a starting off point consistently in Australia." The man was further accused of playing a significant role in the importing almost 2 tons of cocaine in 3 plots in the past year alone, with an estimated street value of $683 million, and allegedly arranged the importation and collection of 560 kilograms of cocaine in Western Australia in August 2023. Since last year, police suspect the man was involved in the conspiracies to import a further 20 tons of drugs into Australia. Police are also investigating his suspected involvement in the trafficking of cocaine, MDMA and methamphetamine across Australia between 2022 and 2024. He's suspected of having outlaw motorcycle gang links. Detective Superintendent Telfer said the arrest would be a significant disruption to the drug trade. "More importantly, is the impact these drugs have if they got into the community. That's the greatest outcome for us, that we're able to prevent that from reaching the community," he said. The man has been charged with several Commonwealth offences relating to drug imports and dealing with the proceeds of crime, and a slew of state-based allegations. If convicted, he faces life behind bars. He was due to front Brisbane Magistrate Court on Thursday, April the 18th. Further raids were carried out in Queensland after the 36-year-old man's arrest. "The investigation doesn't stop today," Detective Superintendent Telfer said. Queensland Police Service Detective Acting Superintendent Brad Phelps said the man allegedly coordinated criminal activity at the highest level, including drive-by shootings, robberies and arson. "This gentleman was a significant threat," he told media on Thursday. "We required specialist resources to assist with his apprehension yesterday. I applaud the efforts of everyone involved to achieve this outcome." Anyone with information has been urged to call Crime Stoppers on 1-800-333-000. That's Crime Stoppers, 1-800-333-000. And that article on page 3 was Shooting, Firebombs and Drugs, was by Anna Falkenmeier. And then we have a couple of small unattributed items. Still on page 3. Hail hits region before wet weekend. Hail has hit parts of the Hunter on Thursday ahead of what shapes as a wet weekend throughout the region. Cessnock recorded the most rain in the region by Thursday afternoon, notching 9.6 millimetres at the Cessnock Airport weather station between 9 a.m. and 5:30 p.m. Maitland was close behind with 9 millimetres. In Newcastle, developing showers on Friday are expected to offer a prelude to rain on Saturday. Showers are forecast across the region on the weekend, including at Singleton, Muswellbrook and Scone. That was Hail Hits Region Before Wet Weekend. And the final item on page 3, unattributed, Minister's Hunter Office Vandalised. The late Macquarie Electorate Office of Federal Shortland MP and Defence Industry Minister Pat Conroy has been vandalised. Free Palestine graffiti and smashed windows was discovered at the Belmont office on Thursday morning. We have a vibrant democracy, and that includes the right to protest, but that should be done in a respectful way, Mr. Conroy told the Newcastle Herald. The office on the Pacific Highway was still able to open to the public, and authorities have been notified. That was the last article, page 3. Minister's Hunter Office Vandalised.
I'm Angela Caterns, and you're tuned to 2RPH, providing readings of the Newcastle Herald every weekday from 10 a.m. and on Saturdays from 2 p.m.
Well, it's 27 and a half minutes past 10 on 2RPH, your radio reading service. Page 4 in today's Newcastle Herald. Crime spree, man who robbed bottle shop, carjack driver, given paroles hours before robbery, out of prison and straight into trouble. This is by Nick Bilby. A man who held up a Hunter bottle shop while armed with a knife and carjacked an elderly man within hours of being released on parole has been sentenced to a maximum of 4 years in jail. Dane Adam Williams, 41, faced Newcastle District Court via video link from Clarence Correctional Centre on Thursday afternoon as Judge Roy Ellis handed down the penalty. The court heard that Williams was released from custody at Cessnock Correctional Centre on the morning of March 29, 2022. While he was paroled to a boarding house in Sydney, Judge Ellis said that the Queensland man was shown the door and released in the Hunter, left to make his own way from Cessnock to Sydney, despite having little means or knowledge of the local area. Only 3 hours after becoming free, Williams held up the Liquorland store in the Cessnock CBD while armed with a 20-centimetre long kitchen knife. He stole a carton of pre-mixed gin cans and $450 cash from the store, which was being run by a lone female attendant. After he was then rejected by a nearby driver when he asked for a lift, Williams got into the passenger seat of another car occupied by a man who was waiting for his wife to finish shopping. The court heard the man refused to drive Williams anywhere at first, but changed his mind after he saw the knife. Williams cried and apologised while in the car. He told the driver he had never seen anything like this before. The driver wanted to take Williams to a train station, but the parolee asked to be let out on the ride. "I'm sorry I had to put you through that, but I was desperate to get out of town," Williams said to the driver as he got out of the vehicle and left two cans of gin for him. Williams made his way to a service station at Kersley, where he stole a red Lexus sedan, which was in the process of being refilled by an 85-year-old man. But before Williams could drive away in the vehicle, the elderly man repeatedly opened the car door and punched him multiple multiple times over several minutes as Williams sat in the driving. CCTV footage of the carjacking was played to the court on Thursday. Judge Ellis said it appeared Williams restrained himself from using significant violence against the 85-year-old. He was arrested later that day when the Lexus was spotted on the M1 at Beresfield. Williams was released from jail to participate in the Ballon A rehabilitation program before he was sentenced, but was kicked out in March after he twice failed a drug test. Judge Ellis gave Williams a 25% discount on his penalty because he pleaded guilty at the earliest opportunity. With the sentence backdated to account for time he had already spent in custody for these crimes, he'll be first eligible for parole in October. That was Out of Prison and Straight into Trouble. That was by Nick Bilby on page 4. Also on page 4, Port Bullish on Potential for Offshore Wind Manufacturing. This story by Matthew Kelly. This is the full story from the front page. And Port of Newcastle has released artist impressions showing how a future offshore wind manufacturing facility could transform the port over the next decade. Manufacturing would be at several locations, including the North Arm and Walsh Point. It's going to be a huge operation. It'll probably be on a similar scale to building ships in Adelaide, Port of Newcastle's executive manager of projects and assets, Raymond Hull, said. The port recently commissioned a study to its capability and requirements for offshore wind manufacturing. It found that with suitable a sustainable manufacturing industry could be established. It also confirmed the view of several wind companies and the Maritime Union of Australia regarding the port's natural advantages, including a deep draft navigation channel, available development area, and the absence of bridge infrastructure. It is likely that the basic turbine components will be built at the North and transferred to Walsh Point for assembly. It is estimated that Hunter Offshore Wind will create 300 full-time jobs and 3,000 construction jobs. The port study also said there was sufficient land available on Kooragang Island to accommodate the Hunter Valley hydrogen hub and offshore manufacturing. The good news is that we would not have to do land reclamation like other sites would, Mr. Hull said. We have space and infrastructure available at different spots in the port where we can facilitate the different manufacturing processes. The port is hopeful the federal government fund the manufacturing facility as part of its investment in the Hunter Offshore Wind Zone. We believe clean energy will play a big part in the Port of Newcastle. We want to facilitate that diversification, Mr. Hull said. But we have to wait until the permits have been awarded before we put more time and effort into it. A spokeswoman for Energy and Climate Change Minister Chris Bowen said offshore wind presented an incredible opportunity for the Hunter through energy and job security as well as onshore manufacturing. The Hunter has always been an industrial powerhouse, and this new offshore wind industry will ensure the region continues to thrive in a net zero economy, she said. After the construction phase had passed, the facilities will be repurposed for maintenance. Once the offshore wind has been established, all you need is a clear line to service it and then some replacement parts at the 15 to 20 year mark, but it wouldn't need such a big setup. The port's proximity to the wind farm would also reduce maintenance costs. The vessels that do this maintenance work cost $500,000 a day. If you need to steam an extra 2 days, you are adding $1 million to the cost of each tower, Mr. Hull said. That story on page 4, Port Bullish on Potential for Offshore Wind Manufacturing. It was by Matthew Kelly.
And we're going to page 5 now. Nationals champion nuclear over wind. And this article is by Matthew Kelly. The coalition would consider ripping up existing clean energy infrastructure contracts worth hundreds of millions of dollars if it wins government. National Party leader David Littleproud has confirmed. Speaking in Nelson Bay yesterday, Mr. Littleproud also confirmed the coalition's opposition to the Hunter Offshore Wind Project and similar projects around the country. Rather, it would pursue an energy mix of nuclear, coal, gas, carbon capture and storage and renewables. The coalition is expected to release details of its energy policy in coming weeks. It has previously indicated it includes a plan for a nuclear reactor in the Upper Hunter. AGL, which owns the former Liddell Power Station and Bayswater Power Station, has ruled out introducing nuclear energy at the sites. Mr. Littleproud said there were other sites in the Upper Hunter that would be suitable for a nuclear generator, but didn't specify where. We don't need to use their, that's AGL's, land. We can be close to it, so we are not tearing up 28,000 kilometres of landscape across the East Coast with new transmission lines, he said. The investment signals that the government is spending is all renewables approach. You can't blame them, AGL, for going down that path. We will change that investment mandate, and that money will flow towards an energy mix that doesn't create a concentrated risk in this country. Hunter-based National Senator Ross Cadell also confirmed his office had been conducting polling on attitudes to new energy in the Upper Hunter. We've been doing some phone canvassing, personal conversations, as well as online. We want to make sure we're not going to put things people don't want them. I'll be happy to share that's the results, in a couple of weeks, because people need to know where it is. Mr. Littleproud met with members of the No Coastal Wind St. Stephen's group regarding their concerns about the potential environmental and economic impact of the proposed Hunter offshore wind project. The federal government has refused to reopen community consultation for the project, despite significant community and industry concerns. Feasibility licences for the offshore wind are due to be awarded in coming months. Mr. Littleproud said the coalition was to stop what he described as the government's reckless race to zero. If they want to continue down this reckless path, there is a consequence. Fortunately, there is a human one as well, he said. He said an incoming coalition would review all existing government agency infrastructure contracts. We'll look at where the existing government took contracts and at what stage they are at, he said. There are some projects on land that we will have to accept, but we're going to just let these things happen. If that means we have to pay out contracts, we will definitely look at that. We are going to make sure we are honest with the Australian people. This, the Hunter offshore wind project, can't happen. And that was Nationals champion nuclear level win by Matthew Kelly. And staying on page 5, the next article is by Marion Ray. Blackouts drive up energy price up. A hot summer and outages triggered by severe storms pushed wholesale electricity prices higher in the first 3 months of the year, the regulator says. A quarterly report released on Thursday showed soaring heat and humidity, increased demand and a severe storm in Victoria sparked outages as congestion in the national grid stopped states sharing supplies. Average quarterly electricity prices in Queensland and Victoria increased by 20% and 9% respectively from a year earlier, the Australian regulator, AER, said. The 2023-24 was Australia's third warmest on record, bringing higher demand for cooling, particularly in Queensland, where daily demand exceeded previous records 3 times during January to March. Severe storms in Victoria on February the 13th felled transmission towers and hit the power supply to South Australia and Tasmania, which contributed to higher prices at price events in all 3 regions. During the quarter, there were 26 high price events when the spot market prices exceeded 5,000 per megawatt per hour, mostly in Queensland, 11 events, Victoria, 5. The issue of congestion in transmission does present a greater risk of high price events when we do have extreme weather or demand conditions, AER board member Jared Ball said. interconnector and network constraints limited Queensland, New South Wales and South Australia's ability to import lower-priced capacity. But Mr. Ball said the government price caps on coal and gas have helped to stabilise prices in recent quarters. Things have generally calmed down and prices are well below where they were in 2022, he said. Forward prices for 2024 and 2025 are well below the energy stock peaks of 2022, but we're yet to return to historic levels. Weather and international events were the X factors for changes in future supply and demand, Mr. Ball said. And weather may be a little bit more predictable than international events, he said. There was relatively little new generation, but a significant increase was scheduled for the rest of 2024 to make up for delays over 2023. Meanwhile, rooftop solar output reached new heights in the last 3 months of 2023 and remained high. In Victoria and South Australia, there was reduced demand on the energy grid due to the increased generation by rooftop solar on sunny yet summer days when air conditioner use is low. Mr. Ball said the rooftop solar to continue to hit fresh records, which must be accommodated. That's very much where a lot of our focus is as well, in terms of some of the decisions we're making about networks and provisioning for more consumer energy sources, he said. East Coast gas market spot prices averaged $11.58 per gigajoule, up 6.9% from December quarter, but down 3.4% on a year ago. And that was page 5. Blackouts Drive Energy Prices Up was by Marion Ray.
Well, you can have her. I don't want her. She didn't love me anyway. She only wanted someone to play with. But all I wanted was love to stay. Well, if you get the wrong woman, there's only one thing that you can do. Just dig a hole and jump right in it and pull the ground right over you.
Broadcasting the Newcastle Herald 6 days a week, here on 100.5 FM, 2RPH, your radio reading service.
And it's 17 minutes to 11 o'clock on 2RPH, your radio reading service. We're on page 6 now of the Newcastle Herald. This story goes over to page 7, so I'll start the article on page 6. Annie will conclude it on page 7. Unlikely, implausible, may have, how Pinnacle reaches conclusions. This is by Sage Swinton. Scott Nalan said the misspelling of his name in Newcastle Herald letters to the editor may have been due to the use of SMS communications. The explanation was revealed in an investigation report into allegations about City of Newcastle CEO Jeremy Barth's connections with Mr. Nalan made public on April 17. The Pinnacle Integrity investigation probed two allegations, whether Mr. Barth passed on confidential information to Mr. Nalan, which Mr. Nalan included in letters to the Herald, or that Mr. Barth wrote one of the letters which related to Newcastle Maritime Museum. The council's referral to Pinnacle related to whether Mr. Barth provided confidential information to Mr. Nalan. It did not ask the investigator to examine if Mr. Barth wrote any of the 18 letters submitted under Mr. Nalan's name, 5 of which were published. Pinnacle did not contact the Herald or ask for the letters. Mr. Barth denied writing the letters or passing on confidential information, and the investigation found no evidence that he did either. The one letter that was included in the allegations related to a complaint by Newcastle Maritime Museum President Bob Cook. The inquiry came after a Herald investigation revealed Mr. Nalan, a good friend of Mr. Bowers for more than 20 years, had been living in Japan for decades. He had wrote a campaign of letters to the Herald which supported Mr. Bowers' career and criticised his critics. The independent investigation established that Mr. Nalan was motivated to write to the Herald about council matters to advocate on issues he held an interest in and through his support and defence of Mr. Bath. The report said whilst it is considered that Mr. Bath has had discussions with Mr. Nalan, a close personal friend, there was no evidence that their discussions included confidential council information. Mr. Nalan said in his written response that he had a right to write to a newspaper and his interest did in part relate to Mr. Bath, but it was also motivated by his love for surfing. He said the information cited in his letters came from Herald articles. Mr. Nalan has never been a Herald subscriber. He believed that the Newcastle Herald intended to defame his and Mr. Bath's reputation and had not on any occasion made attempts to verify his identity. The report said Mr. Nalan submitted that he had originally used his Japan IP address to submit letters, but that because the Herald stopped publishing his letters, he believed the IP address was being blocked. He then reverted to using a virtual private network, VPN, to disguise his IP address as Australian. Mr. Nalan said the VPN belonged to a Japanese friend using an ExpressVPN account, but the friend moved away in 2022. In regards to the misspelling of his own last name, he said that it may have been due to the use of SMS communications, but if so, it was unintentional.
And we're turning to page 7. Mr. Nalan said he may have forgotten the content of some of his letters to the editor, but no letter took him longer than about 5 minutes, and after sending them, he felt better about himself. In relation to why he wrote about Mr. Cook and the Maritime Museum, Mr. Nalan said, Germany had told me he was torn between trying to save the maritime collection and walking away from it all. I just wanted people to know how crazy the situation was. Mr. Bath said in response that Mr. Nalan had always supported his work and career progression. Indeed, when I commenced in this role as CEO of the City of Newcastle, he contacted my entire friend list on Facebook to share the news of my appointment, Mr. Bath said. While his occasional support for issues I have fought for has never materially benefited me, I have always considered myself fortunate to have a friend who has been so willing to publicly support me. The investigator reviewed Mr. Bath's work emails with Mr. Nalan and found they didn't contain any confidential information. Lord Mayor Nuatali Nelms said in her interview the CEO had obviously confided information to Mr. Nalan, but didn't know if that included confidential information. She said that it is hard to limit the scope of conversation between friends, the report said. Assessing evidence, the Herald reported on April the 17th that Mr. Cook was concerned by language in the report, such as reasonable and plausible. Those are not words of an investigator that's approving anything, he said. The report also accused the Herald of making inferences on innuendo. The inferences drawn from Mr. Cook and or the Newcastle Herald articles regarding Mr. Bath's involvement are found on innuendo. And the fact that Mr. Nalan may or may not have used a domestic IP address, it states. When discussing Mr. Nalan's evidence about using a VPN, the report alternatively a domestic user has forwarded correspondence on behalf of Mr. Nalan. Mr. Nalan's evidence, listed in the report, doesn't mention this possibility. He said he used varied platforms to correspond with the Herald, including his personal email address, the web feedback form, and SMS. The investigation also found if Mr. Bath wrote letters, it was unlikely and implausible he would have used a friend's name on them, but rather choose a name without any legitimate connection to himself. That is, he could have adopted a John Doe without any risk of connection to himself or any impact on his professional reputation, the report said. There is no indication that if Mr. Barth used a John Doe, it would have prevented the Newcastle Herald from publishing the content. The investigator did not contact the Herald to ascertain how it verifies letters to the editor. Pinnacle Integrity said the role was to assess available evidence rather than rely on inference, assumptions or innuendo. Whilst the procedural framework that underpins reviews might not satisfy those seeking a desired outcome, conduct reviewers remain bound by those procedures.
And that article on pages 6 and 7, unlikely, implausible, may have, how Pinnacle reaches conclusions, it was by Sade Swinton. The other story on page 6, falls behind 1 in 3 child injury hospital visits. This is by Callum Godd. 1 in 3 injury hospitalisations among Australian children and young people are caused by a fall, with playground equipment the main culprit. A new report from the Australian Institute of Health and Welfare shows there were 603,675 emergency department ED presentations and 88,766 injury hospitalisations among children and adolescents in 2021-22. That represents 28% of all ED presentations and 8.3% of hospitalisations. There was a 14% spike in the age standardised rate of injury hospitalisations among children and adolescents from 1,477 to 1,686 per 100,000 between 2019-20 and 2020-21. But the latest data released on Thursday shows rates have returned to trend, 1,497 per 100,000. Boys made up most of the cohort's injury ED presentations, 58%, and hospitalisations, 61%. Poisoning or toxic effects was the only type of injury girls were more likely than boys to be hospitalised. Falls caused the highest number of hospitalisations, 29,000 cases, followed by contact with objects, 17,400 cases, and transport, 12,000 cases. Playground equipment was the most common cause of falls amongst children, with hospitalisation rates being highest among children aged 5 to 9 years, Institute spokeswoman Heather Swanson said. Sport and active recreation contributed to 21% of injury hospitalisations, and more than a third, 36% of injury hospitalisations were for fractures. Children are at greater risk of certain injuries according to their developmental stage, the Institute said. The most common injuries diagnosed at an ED for children under 9 were head injuries. Infants had the highest rate of injury hospitalisations caused by choking and suffocation, with inhaled food being the most common cause. Children aged 1 to 4 had the highest rate of injury hospitalisations caused by drowning and submersion. The 16 to 18 age bracket had the highest rates of injury hospitalisation overall. That story on page 6 falls behind 1 in 3 child injury hospital visits. It was by Callum Godd.
And we're back to page 7 again. Seven Boss exits early following controversies. Council to spend up on infrastructure. And this is by Jacob Steinman. Seven West Chief Executive James Warburton has jumped ship early after a scandal-plagued tenure in which the media conglomerate lurched from one PR disaster to the next. Mr. Warburton announced his intention last year to step down from the role he has held for half a decade. His departure was slated for the middle of 2024. But after a string of controversies to hit the organisation, culminating in deeply embarrassing revelations and payments made to Bruce Lehrman, the former V8 Supercars chief announced his resignation following a board meeting on Thursday afternoon. He'll be replaced by financial officer Jeff Howard. Chairman Kerry Stokes and Mr. Howard thank Mr. Watson for his contribution to the business over many years. Local government. Newcastle Council has revealed will invest $140 million into infrastructure projects across the city in its 2024 operation plan and budget. The documents, which will be a public exhibition next week, show a total spend of $415 million across 60 services and a modest surplus of $4.1 million. Lord Mayor Nuatali Nelms said in the past decade the council had doubled its annual infrastructure programme this year, and this year's budget would set a record new benchmark. This includes $14.6 million for roads and footpaths across the city, including $5 million for renewing roads in the Western Corridor and $7.7 million on stormwater projects and flood planning in areas such as Mayfield East and Derby Street, Councillor Nelm said. We're also revitalising our coast, city and urban centres with $9.9 million for projects such as the East End Public Domain Plan, Hunter Street Mall, and local centre upgrades at Orchard Town Road, New Lambton, and Georgetown, the Lord Mayor said. Other budget highlights include $21 million to complete the expanded Newcastle Art Gallery, $14.7 million to improve waste management, $11 million on recreation and sports improvements, and $4.5 million on coastal management, including Stockton coastline protection work. Newcastle Council Chief Executive Jeremy Barth estimated the infrastructure programme would create 735 local jobs and increase total economic output in the local government area by up to $305 million. Delivery back-to-back balanced budgets following the pandemic is not an achievement that occurs by accident, he said yesterday. Rather, it is the result of the commitment and passion of our 1,300 staff who have yet again shown that Newcastle is a city that can provide for its citizens without having to take on huge amounts of debt. And that was council to spend upfront on infrastructure.
Though we gotta say goodbye for the summer, baby, I promise you this, I'll send you all my love every day in a letter.
Broadcasting the Newcastle Herald 6 days a week, here on 100.5 FM, 2RPH, your radio reading service.
Coming up 2 minutes to 11 on 2RPH, your radio reading service, page 10 of today's Newcastle Herald. Bondi takes first step in healing. In their honour, public line up to mourn victims of horror stabbing rampage. It's unattributed. The Sydney shopping centre, where six people died after a senseless attack, has become a site for solemn reflection as hundreds gathered to mourn those killed inside. The doors of Westfield Bondi Junction in the city's eastern suburbs reopened to the public on Thursday for the first time since a mass stabbing attack during Saturday afternoon trade. A sombre crowd formed to leave condolences and bouquets on level 4 of the silent shopping centre, where stores will resume trade on Friday. Mothers held children close and wiped away tears as they left. Others crossed their chest in prayer as they descended the escalators. Many wore black. One police officer wore his badge but no uniform as he walked through the centre, his arms linked with another. At the top of the escalator where the so-called bollard man, French construction worker Damien Giraud, confronted the knife-wielding attacker, people queued for coffee. Outside Myer, a message from Bondi store manager Samantha Thomas thanked brave team members, first responders and customers who worked to save lives and keep others safe. New South Wales Premier Chris Minns and Police Commissioner Karen Webb walked through the centre before addressing the media. It is not back to normal for Sydney, but this is an opportunity to get some kind of grieving and to turn the page on what has been a very difficult period, Mr. Minns said. The Premier praised the community for coming together and described the day of reflection as the first step in healing. We are a community that can stand together in difficult periods and show that grief is universal when it is felt by one family, one individual, he said. This vigil is an opportunity for the community to stand together to support and honour the victims and survivors of this horrific tragedy. I hope they can draw some strength from the fact that there's many people that are standing with them during this time. Mr. Minns has indicated stricter knife laws will be considered following the stabbing and a separate attack at a Western Sydney church. Police Minister Yasmin Catley says the state government will also consider similar laws to those implemented in Queensland to allow officers to use metal detectors without a warrant during searches. Webworth MP Allegra Spender said people had been left devastated by the attack in a shopping centre that served as a community hub. Anybody knows it could have been any of us, she said on Thursday. The word I hear most often is senseless and people are shocked and traumatised. Centre Group, which owns and operates the shopping centre, said shops would open for business on Friday with an increased police and security presence. Normal trading hours will be maintained, although some stores will opt to remain shut. Shopping centre tenants' rent will be waived for the period it has been closed, with staff offered mental health support and counselling. Black ribbons were displayed on digital screens at all Westfield locations on Thursday. Security will be increased at all centres in response to their attack. One guard, Faraz Tahir, 30, was among those killed, while fellow security guard Mohammed Tahar remains in hospital. The pair, both Pakistanis, showed enormous courage, and the government would consider extending Mr. Tahar's visa to remain in Australia. Prime Minister Anthony Albanese said, "The reopening for trade will mark almost a week since 40-year-old Joel Couchy went on his stabbing spree. The Queensland man, whose family said lived with mental illness for decades, was shot dead by a police inspector on level 5 of the complex. Six people remain in hospitals across Sydney, with one woman in intensive care in a serious but stable condition, according to New South Wales Health. A 9-month-old baby whose mother was among five women killed in the attack is in hospital in a serious but stable condition. A permanent memorial is being planned near the site, and a beachside candlelight vigil will also be held on Sunday." And there's a number for Lifeline below this article, the Lifeline number 13114. That's 13114, and Beyond Blue 1300 224636. That's 1300 224636. That story was unattributed on page 10. Bondi takes first step in healing.
And page 11 now. Protest calls to keep doors open, and this is by Madeline Link. Plans to shutter the Edgeworth Community Services Centre are ploughing ahead, despite the child protection system being in what union officials describe as a death spiral. At a protest outside the office on Thursday, union delegates banded together to demand the centre remain open and job vacancies be immediately addressed. The first thing that needs to be fixed with the Child Protection Services is addressing the appalling vacancy rates, Public Services Association, that's PSA, Assistant General Secretary Troy Wright said. Once offices are fully staffed, we can start to look at workload practices, we can start looking at refining things, but right now we are on a death spiral in child protection. We're in a death spiral in the sense that too many people are leaving, and those that remain are picking up their loads, unsustainable loads, and burning out as well. It's got to stop. It's understood that the lease at the Edgeworth office, which has capacity to hold more than 50 people, is due to expire in September. There are currently 16 staff who work from the site. Issues with security at the building and underuse of the site is understood to be behind the move to close the office, but PSA delegate and caseworker Nin Bennett said, although it may not be the busiest office, its role is still important. In regards to the time that we spend travelling to and from to see our children, our carers, our families, even down to making those connections with schools, it would add significant time onto our travel each way if we were to move from, say, Edgeworth to Charlestown. There are other community service centres located in Maitland, Cessnock, Raymond Terrace, Mayfield and Charlestown. from the December 2022 quarter to the same period in 2023, caseworker vacancies have grown by more than 83% across the state, according to Department of Communities and Justice DCJ figures. Mr. Wright said the government needs to find measures to keep people in the job, attract new caseworkers, and ensure child protection is fully resourced. When the department is alerted of a child that may be at risk of serious harm, only one in four of those children are being seen, he said. Can you imagine in a hospital emergency department if four patients came in and a doctor said, I cannot see all four of you, I'm only going to see one? Miss Bennett said a feeling unable to do meaningful work is hard on the caseworker as well. It's certainly not easy. You walk out each night and you start questioning whether you've done everything you possibly can for all the children across your caseload to make sure you are making sure you're giving them better outcomes, she said. For me, I personally go home and I feel deflated. I feel like I'm not able to do the job that I was actually employed to do, which is to keep our children safe and make sure those connections are everlasting. That article on page 11, Protest Calls to Keep Doors Open, was by Madeline Link.
The look of love is in.
Broadcasting the Newcastle Herald 6 days a week, here on 100.5 FM, 2RPH, your radio reading service.
Well, it's 6 minutes past 11 o'clock on 2RPH Radio Reading Service. Time for sport, the Newcastle Herald. The back page of the Newcastle, the front page of the sport. Page 72, never say die. Jets ignore dark clouds to chase hat-trick of wins. This story by Robert Dillon. If the end is looming for the Newcastle Jets, then they plan to go out swinging. With their playoffs hopes done and dusted and their club's future still hanging precariously in the balance, the Jets have defiantly strung together back-to-back wins and now aim to finish this campaign with two prize scalps, starting tonight when they host second-place Wellington Phoenix at McDonald Jones Stadium. On Saturday week, Newcastle are at home against the rivals, competition leaders and defending champions, Central Coast Mariners. But beyond that, that is anyone's guess. The club's ownership position has been well documented, and while there are reportedly negotiations playing out in the corridor of power, there is still no guarantee a team representing Newcastle will be part of the A-League next season. Despite all this uncertainty, Jets coach Rob Stanton and his troops have stuck to the task at hand and appear to be gaining strength at a time when lesser characters may have tossed in the towel. It's a reflection of the staff and players working together and staying focused on the picture of playing football and not getting distracted by things they can't control, Stanton said. The Jets bowed out of the finals race some weeks ago, but there were still goals that they have continued to pursue. The first was to avoid the wooden spoon, which they have successfully achieved. Next is to improve from their current position of 10th and finish in the top 8, which would ensure direct qualification in the next season's Australia Cup knockout. And on an individual basis, striker Apostolos Stamatopoulos needs one goal to break the club record and remains in contention for the A-League Golden Boot. It would be really nice for him to score a couple more goals and possibly even run down the Golden Boot, Stanton said. It would be nice, it would be fitting for him, it would be good to see. The Jets have not won 3 consecutive games since 2017-18 and their record winning streak is 4 on the bounce. It's time to go 3 in a row, which would be fantastic. I think we're set up to do that, Stanton said. Stanton said skipper Brandon O'Neill, who has been granted a release to return to Perth at the end of the season, was there to be selected if we need him, after he was an unused substitute in last week's win against Brisbane. But he added that, "I'm also looking at the future as well and was happy with the job young Tyros, Callum Timmins and Costa Grozos have been doing in the midfield. As for the uncertainty surrounding the club's future, Stanton said, I'm not losing any sleep over something I can't control. Let's throw a page, never say die, just ignore dark clouds to chase hat-trick of wins. It was by Robert Dillon."
And page 69, handpicked Jets gaining attention. A-League women. And this is by Rennie Valentine. They don't have a cast of big-name stars like the successful Newcastle Jets teams past. But coach Ryan Campbell said the Jets had signed everyone they wanted this A-League's women campaign, and those players' stocks had risen on the way to a semi-final showdown with Premier's Melbourne City. The Jets had Matildas Cheryl Salisbury, Joey Peters, Kate Gill and Amber Nielsen, plus a baby-faced Emily Van Egmond, in their lineup for the club's first ever final appearance in 2008-2009. In 2017-18, Van Egmond and now Everton midfielder Claire Wheeler were leading the charge along with four quality American imports. This time around, there were no Matildas in their midst, but a crop of lesser-known players are getting the job done. We recruited a team that we knew was going to be able to implement the style of play that we wanted to bring in, and we got a certain type of people as well that we knew would buy into how we're trying to play as an overall," Campbell said. "People might not think they're the biggest names on paper, some of the players that we have, but I believe they all represent Newcastle and they all represent the type of people and the type of player that we want as a club. Someone like Serena Bolden is the perfect example of that. Someone that most other clubs could have chosen to sign and they didn't. Then you've got people like Melina Ayres, who knows what success means. So maybe it's not the biggest name squad, but I believe we're also making names for those players, and some of those players that people didn't know about are now starting to have a bigger name, which is credit to them and it's credit to the team and what we've done as a club as well." Bolden rose to prominence by scoring the Philippines' first ever World Cup goal last year, but couldn't secure an A-League contract until being signed late by the Jets. She has produced 14 goals in 18 outings since. Only recalled Matilda's striker Michelle Heyman scored more. Bolden also leads the league in assists and will be key in the Jets breaking new ground by beating City. Not that the Jets are reading much into the club's winless record of 15 exchanges with the league's four-time champions. The only record we'll speak about is the fact that we've played Melbourne City twice this season and we've lost twice, Campbell said. That's the only team that we've lost both our games to, so we want to change that. The semi-finals are played across a home and away format. The Jets host the first leg at Maitland Sports Ground, 3 p.m. on Sunday. The return leg in Melbourne is April the 28th. And that item on page 69, handpicked Jets gaining attention, was by Rennie Valentine.
Reading newspapers, books and magazines every day. This is your radio reading service, 2RPH.
14 minutes past 11 on 2RPH, your radio reading service. Today's editorial is on page 54. It'll be read by Annie.
Violence against first responders, not on. One of the most shocking aspects of the riot outside the church where the Assyrian Christian bishop was stabbed was how soon it came after another event that had led to an outpouring of support for police and paramedics. It was men and women in uniform who ran towards danger in the wake of the attack at Bondi Junction when a lone New South Wales police inspector shot a mentally ill man armed with a knife who killed six people and left mothers, including an infant, badly injured. Paramedics, other police and first responders had also rushed to the scene to assist the fallen, despite not knowing whether or not the danger had been neutralised. While the outrage felt by members of the Abyssinian Christian community at the attack on a bishop by a 15-year-old youth, apparently motivated by criticism of his Islamic faith, was understandable, it does not in any way justify what happened next. A crowd of about 500 people quickly gathered outside the Assyrian Orthodox Church of Christ of the Good Shepherd in Wakeley after the attack, which had been live-streamed during a church service. A lynch mob mentality developed, with supporters of Bishop Murray Emmanuel yelling, "An eye for an eye," and "Bring him out, bring him out." That call was apparently directed at police in the church to arrest the 15-year-old attacker, who was pinned down and was being restrained by members of the congregation. As the crowd built and emotions became even more intense, members of the crowd began shooting officers with whatever came to hand. One officer's short jaw was broken and was struck with a fence paling. Another suffered lesser injuries. Paramedics, who had initially been called to tend to the bishop, a priest who had also been stabbed, and the alleged attacker, who had been injured while being restrained by parishioners, were put to the impossible situation. Our paramedics came directly under threat and had to retreat into the church, New South Wales Ambulance Commissioner Dominic Morgan said. "This is outrageous. Our people go to care and help every single day. They need to know that they've got the support of the community." At least six paramedics remained holed up inside the church for the next 3.5 hours as more and more police were called to bring the situation under control. Rioters also caused hundreds of thousands of dollars damage to 20 police cars, 10 of which were so badly trashed they had to be towed from the scene and neighbouring properties. While the broader community is, quite rightly, appalled by the attack on Bishop Marmaree, the attack on the first responders is also incredibly disturbing. Political leaders, including New South Wales Premier Chris Minns, local council and MPs, are to be commended for their swift response. Mr. Minns convened a meeting of religious leaders who issued a joint statement condemning the initial attack and called for calm. New South Wales Police Commissioner Karen Webb was quick to read the riot act to those who had attacked police and paramedics. "Police attended the incident in Wakeley to assist the community and the crowd turned on police," she said. Those that were involved in that riot can expect a knock on the door. While that is clearly what the public would expect, it is imperative that the authorities don't respond in such a heavy-handed manner that an already volatile situation is inflamed further. It's essential that cool heads prevail. And that editorial, "Violence Against Police Responders Not On," was on page 54.
On 2RPH, your radio reading service, this is Your Say, a selection of letters to the editor from today's edition of The Herald.
And you'll find today's letters on page 55. We start with John Cooper of Charlestown. Sir Anthony Albanese has now come up with a Future Made in Australia plan, which is, by any rational analysis, planned to increase subsidies for the green manufacturing sector. The plan seems a replica of the US Green Subsidies Plan, oddly named the Reduction Inflation Act, which does not appear to be all that well, given the latest US annual inflation rate was 3.5%, up from 3% from the previous year. Given the high and rising energy costs involved in Albo's Green Plan, it appears to be the antithesis of its objectives. The plan has come in for criticism from expert economists, in particular the Labor-appointed head of the Productivity Commission, who warned the plan could divert investment to productive parts of the economy. One would have thought any government plan on productivity would have been run by the Productivity Commission in the first instance, but obviously our government knows what it is doing. For the nation's sake, I hope this is not a green thought bubble, an election stunt or political ideology.
Julie Robinson of Cardiff. Not one is winning as war rages. The term non-combatant is used several times in Milton Caine's recent letter, Israel Erred But Not Heartless. That was the 13th. Civilian could be used in its place, but why not use the word Palestinians, hating people, rather than the more formal dehumanizing war term? There have been way too many aid and humanitarian workers targeted. The Israeli authorities are usually notified of vehicles, and they are always well marked. Also, many journalists, hospitals and refugee camps have been bombed. Hamas members may or may not be in various places, but that is no excuse for the destruction of buildings and tens of thousands of innocent lives. Retaliation, land, religion, and the fulfillment of religious prophecy are not excuses for war. There can be no winners, only losers.
From Neil Jamison of Merriweather, with regards to the Merriweather right-of-way issue, the City of Newcastle spokesperson appears to be misinformed. An alternative walkway through the adjacent fire station is not an option. Never was, never is, and never will be. Council officers should have known that when they met on-site with fire station personnel way back in 2022 before trying to sell the idea to the community. I imagine they definitely would have known it when informed in writing by the department that a track through an emergency operations area was simply untenable. Moreover, a quick glance at Council's own site maps should have rendered it an impossibility from the get-go. Why? There was a privately owned property at the rear of the fire station that would also have to be traversed in order for the pathway to reach its destination. Put simply, the fire station route was always mission impossible. Given the above, it was disappointing but revelatory to see our spokesperson still flogging this dead horse. Instead of repeating mistakes of the past, council might get together with the developers and broker a real solution.
Steve Barnett of Fingal's Bay. Why Beckham works with Butcher. Four decades into my trade, nothing gives me more satisfaction than a Saturday in the butchery. Unfortunately, we don't close at 12 p.m. these days. We don't want anyone to starve to death because of regulating trading hours. So we work all day, no weekends. Every day is why have a calendar anymore? It's just one through day. Through day to 365 or 366. I call that overtime. Anyway, Saturday is a good day. Parents come in with their children who, this time of the year, have started playing winter sports. My partner in crime, Noel, Mr. Wallsend, is like Mike Rabbit behind the counter, asking all the kids how the game went today in true sports reporter mode. So did you win today? Yep. The kids will say. What was the score? The young ones give Noel the result of the game, and he continues to interview them on their performance, the ref, the whole box and dice, leaving the parents and other customers laughing out loud. But last Saturday took the cake, Noel. So, mate, did you win? The kid says. Yep, I scored 3 goals. Well done, Noel said. But I used to score 6 goals every game when I played. The young fella instantly said, "If you were that good, why are you a butcher?" I like him, Noel replies. My last name is Beckham. It was my destiny to be a butcher. Own goal, Noel, in his nickname now.
Your say. Be listening for more Letters Editor tomorrow at 10 to 4 on your radio reading service, 2RPH.
Inject your soul, sweet rock and roll. I'm a cement mixer, a churning urn, a burning fire. I'm a cement mixer, a churning urn, a burning fire.
Glenn Harden on piano. It was his birthday yesterday. Time for some birthdays. If it is your birthday, very happy birthday to you on this 19th of April. You're sharing it with many paths. We start with Roger Sherman, the American lawyer and founder, one of the founding fathers of the US, born in 1721. He died in 1793 at the age of 72, and the only person to sign all four great state papers of the US, the Continental Association, Declaration of Independence, Articles of Confederation, and the Constitution. The anniversary of the birthday of Elliot Ness, born in 1903, died at the age of 54 in 1957, American Prohibition agent, and known for efforts to bring down Al Capone in the Prohibition era of the early 1930s, while enforcing Prohibition in Chicago, leader of a team of law enforcement officers nicknamed the Untouchables, and of course subsequently was a TV series starring Robert Stack in the title role and a movie starring Kevin Costner as Elliot Ness. Harold Dickey Bird is turning 91 today. The English cricket umpire had a long umpiring career, became a much-loved figure. His excellent umpiring and his eccentricities, played with Yorkshire with Geoffrey Boycott, also born the same as Michael Parkinson in Barnsley, umpired in 66 tests and 69 one-day internationals. Autobiography published in 1990. Sold more than a million copies. He was awarded an MBE, and there's a 6-foot statue of Dickie Bird in Barnsley, which was erected in 2009. Dudley Moore would have been 60. Would have been having a birthday today. He died sadly at the age of 66 in 2002. Comedian, actor, musician, and composer, along with Peter Cook, collaborated in and two others as well. Collaborated in the BBC comedy review Beyond the Fringe. They collaborated on the BBC with Not Only But Also as well. They starred in movies Bedazzled and also The Hound of the Baskervilles. They also received the 1966 Academy of Television Award for Best Entertainment Performance. They performed together until the mid-70s when Dudley moved to the US. He starred in movies Foul Play and 10, was Oscar-nominated for the movie Arthur with John Gielgud and Liza Minnelli, won a Golden Globe, and it was diagnosed with progressive supranuclear palsy in 1999 and died sadly in 2002. Cricketer Jason Gillespie is 49 today. He's also a cricket coach as well, former fast bowler, and also a competent lower-order batsman. He had a top score of 201 in, ironically, his last test match against Bangladesh. 71 tests for Australia, 259 wickets at an average of 26.13, best of 7 for 37, batting average of 18.73. And Maria Sharapova is 37 today, former world number one tennis player, was on the WTA from 2001 to 2020, number one for 21 weeks, and one of 10 women to achieve the career Grand Slam, won the Australian Open in 2008, the French Open in 2012 and 2014, Wimbledon 2004, and the US Open in 2006, also featured on a Sports Illustrated swimsuit edition, and ads for Canon, Nike, and also Prince, and was the face of fashion labels, including Cole Haan. And Alan Price is turning 82 today, one of the founding members of the Animals, English musician. He was with the Animals for 2 years. He was the keyboardist, of course, left the band due to creative differences and also a fear of flying as well. But this is one of the songs that he was on, also with Don't Let Me Be Misunderstood as well. Happy birthday to Alan Price, inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame as well as a member of the Animals in 1994. That's all we have time for today's Newcastle Herald. We'd like to thank the publishers for their cooperation. 2RPH brings you the Newcastle Herald every weekday at 10 o'clock and on the Saturdays at 2 p.m. Stand by now for Pam Nemeny and Peter Theodore with their presentation of The Australian Today. Features for on this afternoon at 4 o'clock. My thanks, as always, to Annie Carr for joining me today. Thank you, Annie.
Oh, thank you, Peter. Bye, listeners.
Enjoy your weekend. Stay safe. See you next time.
This recording of the Newcastle Herald will remain on the site for a period of 24 hours only, which will expire at 11:30 for Saturday. 2RPH sincerely thanks the publisher for cooperation in allowing us to provide this audio file. You are reminded that the material is copyright and is available for personal listening only.